Tonight on Arena, Armando Iannucci on the stage version of Dr. Strangelove and Molly Toomey and Louis Dupuyer on the Circling the Square Poetry Festival. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Who would have thought that a film which finds the comedy in mutually assured nuclear destruction would go on to become a much beloved cult classic? That is the case, of course, with Stanley Kubrick's 1964 feature, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. The film imagines the ultimate doomsday scenario where a paranoid American general goes rogue, launches a nuclear missile on attack on Russia, leaving the mild-mannered American president to warn the Kremlin and come to terms with the new world order this action inevitably leads to. The great Peter Sellers took on three roles in the film: the aforementioned US president, American Muffley, group captain Lionel Mandrake, and of course the Dr. Strangelove of the film's titled, a mad scientist and former Nazi who has very particular ideas about how the human race can survive this nuclear catastrophe. Wow. A new stage version of Dr. Strangelove, starring Steve Coogan, is about to open at London's West End. And this new show will come to Dublin's Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in February of next year. In it, Steve Coogan takes on not three, but four roles, adding bomber pilot Major Kong to his already busy roster. The show is adapted for the stage by the great writer and satirist Armando Iannucci and the man behind hit shows like The Thick of It and Veep. Sinead Egan met Armando Iannucci and co-adapter Sean Foley to talk about the project, which is the first time any of Kubrick's works have been brought to the stage. Before we hear that conversation, let's remind ourselves of the humour within the film itself. We're in the war room scene. Sellers, as President Muffley, has the unenviable task of telling the Russian president what is about to happen.
Now then, Dmitry, you know how we've always talked about the possibility of something going wrong with the bomb. The bomb, Dmitry. The hydrogen bomb. Well, now, what happened is one of our base commanders, he had a sort of, well, he went a little funny in the head. You know, just a little funny. And he went and did a silly thing. Well, I'll tell you what he did. He ordered his planes to attack your country. Well, let me finish, Dmitry. Let me finish, Dmitry. Well, listen, how do you think I feel about it?
Well, it's fundamentally a conflict between NATO and the Russian president, so it seems very relevant. I mean, that when we were first approached about making the stage adaptation, that was the last thing on our minds. And we saw it originally as a metaphor for, I don't know, global warming or, you know, the 101 other doomsday scenarios that we're being presented with. But now, as we're about to, you know, as curtain is about to go up, here we are, and the Iron Curtain coming down again.
Was that clever?
It was. It was brilliant. I don't know what you brought it round perfectly. Yeah, it's perennially relevant, isn't it? That's the thing about the film. It's a brilliant, brilliant movie, obviously for a lot of reasons, but the main reason is that the theme of it and the politics that it's talking to, which is not just around, you know, the power plays of this state, that state, Russia, NATO, but is also around the sort of how men react. A huge part of the satire of the film is about men being really stupid.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
And status, isn't it? It's all about trying to maintain their status over somebody else, even if it involves the destruction of the planet.
Yeah,
they won't make that concession.
So the film was made in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was a sense of geoglobal paranoia, and those themes are kind of writ large in the film. So as you're adapting it, how are you adapting to the now?
Well, it's being aware of these the themes now that are not just about, you know, the potential for a nuclear conflict, the images of war and destruction that we're seeing on a daily basis, our inability to deal with the climate emergency of quite a large percentage of the world claiming it doesn't exist. There's a lot in the original film about conspiracy theories and paranoia and, you know, misinformation.
Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face?
And duplicity and the politicians resorting to rhetorical tricks to say one thing when they mean another. And it's frightening how timeless all those issues are, really.
That's so true, because you were speaking earlier about, well, we were speaking earlier about prescience and your prescience and Stanley Kubrick's. How great is it to actually have that gift when you're talking about these terrible things?
I would call it a gift, but it's, I mean, our stuff is really based on educated guesses. You know, we do a lot of research and then try and imagine what the next thing would be. But it's all based on truth, though, that's the thing. The more true you are to what actually was happening, and that's what Kubrick did when he constructed the storyline. It's all based on true incidents and potential incidents. You know, the film opens with this notice outside an army base, an American army base, saying, was it
peace is our profession.
Peace is our profession. I thought that was a Kubrickian joke, like something from 1984 or something. But it wasn't. It's true. There's a photo. He's got a photo of that army base with that sign in the archive. Yeah.
Can I ask about the? Obviously, this is a much loved film. It's a cult classic. You know, this is the first time that Kubrick has been adapted for the stage, I believe. So, how do you make it your own in that sense?
Well, you know, you ask yourself, what was it about the original that really made you want to take on the project? You know, what was it that ignited your passion? I mean, it's one of my favourite all-time films. What is it about the film? I mean, Sean mentioned it's that tightrope it walks between bleak drama and heightened comedy. So dexterously done. So you want to maintain that, but you don't want to be so overprecious that you feel you can't add something or you can't change something, or you have to be confident about yourself. Why did I want to take this on? Why did Sean want to take it on? Because we really love the film. Why did they ask us to take it on? Okay, what is it about us that we can bring to it? You know, and that's not to say we should be overly confident about it, but it's about what is it that we can bring to it that can make people enjoy watching this story once again, but in a new way and alive and in the theatre.
You mean people could actually stay down there for 100 years?
It would not be difficult, mein Führer. Nuclear reactors could... I'm sorry, Mr. President. Nuclear reactors could provide power almost indefinitely. Greenhouses could maintain plant life. Animals could be bred and slaughtered. Quick survey would have to be made of all the available mine sites in the country. But I would guess that a dwelling space for several hundred thousand of our people could easily be provided.
Well, I would hate to have to decide who stays up and who goes down.
Well, that would not be necessary, Mr. President. Could easily be accomplished with a computer. And the computer could be...
And can I reply that question back to Steve Coogan, obviously, who is, you know, taking on this role, these four roles, not just three, four roles, that were made so famous by another man, by Peter Sellers. How is he managing to make it... not him playing Peter Sellers playing these roles?
Well, that's exactly, you know, neither Sean or myself, and the first thing Steve said was he didn't want to do an impression of Peter Sellers because he's Steve Coogan. You know, and I've had the privilege and the joy of the last 30 years watching Steve be able to take on a character and just make it, you know, flesh it out, make it three-dimensional. So I don't think there's anyone else who could conceivably even think about doing this to those iconic characters. And watching the rehearsals, I can see, you know, why. I can see why he's the person to make it his own.
The other thing you've got to think about it in the context of going, well, they are characters. They just happen to have only been played by one actor so far.
Yeah, yes.
It's like going, well, you know, who could have done Hamlet after seeing the very first Hamlet? You know, you go, well, I mean, that was the definitive Hamlet, wasn't it? But there have been thousands, tens of thousands probably, of Hamlets since that particular role was written. Now, I'm not saying there's going to be tens of thousands of people doing these parts, but in the end, they are parts. They are characters. They are there to be interpreted. They are there to be renewed. And that's what Steve's doing.
You've worked a lot, Sean, on... So the usual adaptation route, right, is book to film or stage to film. But this isn't... This is, and there are far more of them now, of film to stage. It's becoming much more common. What is it about that route that is making it become more popular these days, do you think?
There's a couple of answers to that, one of which is definitely sort of commercial imperative, by which I mean if titles become very well known, people are more likely to go and see them. It's as simple as that. But that goes for books as well. You know, Harry Potter was a book. Then it became the amazingly successful series of films. And it's always been that way. You know, film is a medium which has been around for, what, 120, 130 years. But before that was around, people were still doing it, people borrowing off other stories. You know, operas become plays, plays become books. You know, it's just how things happen. And I'm always slightly averse to going, because a lot of people do this in the sort of theatre world, particularly in the UK, and go, oh, it's so awful, you know, so awful that, you know, now we're relying on films becoming plays. Why is it awful? There's no reason. I mean, it's just, if it's good, it's good. It's your job to make something good. It's your job to create a great night at the theatre. But the source material could be anything.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Armando, you talked about the comedy and the terror of this piece. Which wins out? And what state do you expect the audience to leave in?
I would like to, I hope, go home feeling happy and uplifted, remembering some of their funniest moments. But also, you know, if they draw from a reflection of that story set in the 1960s feels like it hasn't changed and here we are again, then that's fine. Also, if it makes them want to go and watch the film, then that's great as well.
I think there's a kind of, within the whole thing, which is talking about the drama and the comedy of it, is there's a kind of, in a sense, a kind of intellectual pessimism about the whole thing, but there's the joy of comedy alongside it. And that's sort of the duality that we're trying to create in the theatre show as well.
OK, off you go.
What do you mean?
I've got this covered. Go and find the next thing. Talk to that Chad boy, the boy from The Shining. Go on, it'll be easy peasy lemon squeezy.
No, it won't. It will be difficult, difficult, lemon difficult. That is what it will be.
Armando, what role does comedy have now? You know, facing politics on? I mean, people talk about us living in a post-irony, post-satire world as one of the great ironists, one of the great satirists. Where does that leave you and how do you feel about it?
That's such a big question that is probably not going to get a funny answer. where is it? I kind of think... I still gravitate towards, you know, if I want to watch something of an evening, I want to watch something that's funny, you know, even if it just takes us out of the moment for a while, or if it just wonderfully, in the space of 30 seconds, sums up the absurdity of what's just happened, then I'm all for it, really.
POTUS is not going to be running for a second term.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to run. Whoa,
ma'am, give me the straight poop here. Is this for real?
It's totally for real.
Oh, thank you. Can we make it public?
No. You're going to wait for POTUS to make a statement.
Okay. Ma'am, of all the places that I have liaised, I have enjoyed liaising here the most. And for the record, ma'am, I always believed in you.
Well, I have to say that I believed in me, too.
Of course. Yes.
I have to ask, obviously there's an election coming up in the States and there's been a resurgence of Veep.
Yeah, I was surprised when it happened because I'd completely forgotten what the storyline was, and then I realised, oh yes, we had her then run for president because the real president had. So if we follow the storyline to its conclusion, then the election itself will end up as a tie with the Electoral College, and then then goodness knows where we are. And looking at the polls, it may well do. So
Watching between your fingers?
I didn't write beyond that. That's when I got out of VEEP, so I have no solution.
What a pleasure to meet you both, and thank you so much for talking to Irina this evening.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
We'll meet again. Don't know where.
There, of course, with We'll Meet Again, which you will remember from that famous final scene of Doctor Strangelove. And before that, we heard Armando Iannucci and Sean Foley talking about their new stage adaptation of Doctor Strangelove, starring Steve Coogan. It will be at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre from the 5th through to the 22nd of February next year. That's 2025, folks. Information and tickets, you can find out all you need to know on boardgoshenergytheatre.ie. The third annual Circling the Square Festival takes place at the Source Arts Centre in Thurles. This month, the lineup includes poets Rita Ann Higgins and Victoria Kennefic and guitarist and composer Hugh Buckley. The festival began 2 years ago to mark the 10th anniversary of the death of the poet and critic Denis O'Driscoll. Circling the Square was an autobiographical essay Denis had written about growing up in Thurles. The aim of the festival is to pay tribute to Denis by inviting poets who knew him along with those of a younger generation who will read his poems. I'm delighted that two poets join me on the programme this evening, Molly Toomey from our Cork studio and Louis Dupuyre in Galway. Both Louis and Molly will be involved in their own separate events, but they're together for part of a discussion that is called Finding the Words, What is Poetry Now? Welcome to both of you. And I'll turn to you first on this one, Louis. Finding the Words, what is Poetry Now? Your new collection is called Cé Amhairí, Emma Vic Fáthúna. And it really looks directly, this collection and that poem in particular, I think looks directly at the power of poetry and the job of the poet in the modern day across several different realms, not least of which is the political. Tell us about that poem and the collection's title.
Sure, Sean. I suppose I should say that it's a great pleasure to be on the same programme as Armando Iannucci. And I wondered, it is relevant, I suppose, to the discussion of poetry. I wondered if we gave him a tent, would he come here and set up camp for a couple of weeks and give us the benefit of his humour and his savagery in the run-up to the next election? The book that has just come out, as you said, is called Cé Amhairí, Emma Vic Fáthúna. I didn't realise until about an hour ago that today is actually her anniversary. And it took me a while to put this book together. Most of the poems had been written, but the book hadn't declared itself as a book until I realised that the poems of political anger and rage at the centre of the book are the core element of it, really. And the poem Fáir Emma Vic Fáthúna is central to that. It's a fairly crude poem. It's based on the old thing of who killed Cock Robin, and one after the other, all those who were instrumental in her death say, it wasn't me, it wasn't me, it wasn't the Taoiseach, it wasn't the various health officials, it wasn't the state solicitors and all the rest of it. And finally, she herself speaks and says, well, in the end, it was all of you who accepted that rage was a one-day wonder only. And I suppose I was accusing myself and all of us, really, and the idea that we move very quickly from horror to pity and from anger to sympathy and sadness. But sadness changes nothing. Anger does. It has a bad rap. But the fact that both Peter McVerry and Ken Loach in their 80s say it's what gets them up in the morning means that it's also connected to hope. So I would like to think that while there is a real rage in these poems against the injustice that is built into the health system, and particularly, in particular, it's a barbaric health system, the fact that the last three Taoiseach were health ministers, and that it was no impediment to their rise to the top that they made a hames of the health system. I think that kind of beggars belief that incompetence can flourish to that extent, and that everybody ultimately washes their hands and sympathises with the bereaved as if somehow they could have done nothing about it.
And the sympathy and the sorrow is supposed to get over the anger and the difficulties and the things that needed to be solved, I think, is part of what you're saying in the poem as well. We should remember, I mean, obviously Emma Vic Vahuna, as you say, it is extraordinary that it is her anniversary this very day. Young woman who died of terminal cancer following incorrect smear test results. I think you heard her. Did you hear her? Chulatú Iag Glóirtear Radio an the Gaeltacht. I think it was Nogalev on Radio an the Gaeltacht that you heard that particularly spoke to you in some way, Louis.
Yeah, people remember the interview she did on Morning Ireland where she was very distressed and kind of broken. But the interview that Helen Ihe did with her on Radio na Gaeltachta was extraordinary. She was funny. She was fully alive. She was full of what my mother would have called tispach, a kind of an energy that said, geez, I'd love to meet her. I mean, there was some kind of force radiating from her, and the idea that she was so alive and yet her own death was already incubating within her. I mean, it was extraordinarily poignant. And I just think we forget these things, and forgetting is a form of forgiveness. It's an unforgivable form of forgiving, if you like. I don't think it's sufficient to just say that was an awful thing, but it's past. I mean, we don't have to go back awfully far to the blood scandal. You know, every which way you turn, the state which is supposed to protect us, the state which will not commit the resources to the health system, which is the most basic of all of our needs, those who are responsible for it continue to wash their hands of it and claim that they can do nothing about it. And they continue to flourish, and it's not just there, it's right across the board. There's this sense being communicated constantly by various Taoiseach that, oh, if only I could do something about it, I would. Well, if not you, who?
Yeah. Molly Toomey in our Cork studio, listening to Louis there express those opinions so eloquently. I wonder what is the rage in your stomach that sets you down at the blank page to write? Mm-hmm. And is there sadness, the way Louis described it there, this kind of sadness that can pull you away perhaps from the rage, but that rage should never be forgotten?
Yeah, God, thank you so much, Louis. That was so passionate and well said. And I, you know, you just said, you know, forgetting is a form of forgiveness, which will stay with me. I think that's really a remarkable thing to say, and I absolutely agree with you. And yes, I do often do come to the page with rage, and I totally agree that rage can be a transformative emotion, and possibly one of the only emotions that does spring us to action. And poetry can kind of spark that action as well. I do believe that. So yeah, thank you, Louis. That was profound.
You might talk to us, Molly, a little bit about your poem "I Run After Dark," which I think has a fair amount of annoyance, to say the very least, within it.
Yeah, I suppose it does. Yeah, it kind of tackles gender-based violence, and would stem from conversations I've had with men that I love following high-profile cases. And that poem in particular does reflect on how society places the burden on women to be careful instead of addressing the root causes of gender-based violence. But I also do consider that, you know, men too are absolutely victims of patriarchy and gender-based violence, and they, you know, are this kind of, the reality of that does really connect our experiences in complex ways.
And will you give us the poem then?
Yeah, of course.
Do we need a context for what had you out running after dark?
Well, I'll be honest with you. It was following the Aisling Murphy case. You know, I was running a lot at the time, and people were saying, geez, you shouldn't be running at night and stuff. And I kind of was just like, well, I'm going to go out and run after dark because I'm allowed to go out at night. And, you know, I'm going to run in the evening, and I'm going to exist in the world, you know, when it's late, because I should be allowed to. It should be safe for me. So this poem is called "I Run After Dark." Do you want me to read it? Is that what you were saying?
Please, yes.
Yeah, sorry. "I Run After Dark." over papadoms with mango and chili sauce. My brother asks, do I want pepper spray? Can I slide the salad bowl of my skull through a headlock? The men he suggests I fear have the same shoulder width and ragged Jack and Jones sweater as him. I tell him nobody can drag me off Friar's Walk unnoticed. I wear reflector strips, my nails long as blades on the Coast Guard's helicopter. He recommends Muay Thai, judo, boxing, says the street lamps are not enough, as he offers me another papadom like a flat glass lens. I push it away, saving myself for tandoori chicken pinned under the chef's glove's hand as he snaps each leg.
And that's Molly Toomey with her poem I Run After Dark, which I think, is this coming up in a new collection, or are you working towards a new collection? Do you know where it's at yet?
Yeah, I am working towards a new collection, and just, you know, taking it as it comes, you know, whenever poems are coming to me, I'm sitting down and really hoping that it'll all come together in the end. So it's been exciting 2 years.
Absolutely. And Louis, you were saying that it was the death of Emma Vic Fahuna and hearing her speak, I think particularly in that Radio na Gaeltachta interview and the writing of the poem that gives the collection a title, that was when your collection actually came together. But in the poem Rusk, you're not happy with a lot of people here.
No, I mean, I suppose it could be translated easily enough and accurately enough as rant. And I wrote this just before, maybe COVID had just started, but it was the start of 2020. But it was less about COVID than just a reflection on where we were at. I mean, a little bit later in the year, we had a president in America who could not accept that a majority of people had voted against him and was reluctant to leave power. But in fact, the same thing happened here. The two parties that had been rebuked at the polls by the people of Ireland decided that the democratic wishes of the people were that they would conspire ultimately to keep out the party that had received the largest popular vote. I make no claims for any of the parties in all of this, but it seemed an extraordinary moment, and I thought a very low moment for Irish democracy when one party political leader in particular, Micheál Martin, decided that he would not even consider the possibility of negotiating with the party that had got the most votes. So this is Rusk. Will I read it? Is that
yeah, and I suppose we should point out, I'm sure that those who were in those rooms of those negotiations might have other opinions, but that is not what you're on about here. I also think you should think about the translation of that word Rusk as rant. I looked it up today in on changlin.ie. Yeah. I much rather rhetorical composition or rhapsodical chant, which is what I think you're doing. You are kind of, it is a poetic give out is what you're doing.
Absolutely.
But it is rhapsodical.
Yeah, but it's also Rus Cathaoir would be an association of it, which is a kind of a battle cry, if you like. So it is a companion piece to the other one and a poem I have further on in the book, which is about Vicky Phelan as well. But here we go. Here's Rusk. Ní tra suíne sé seo rinne, tra dóchis ná muintaris, ach ré an aí... Well, let's go. Ní tra suíne sé seo rinne, tra dóchis ná muintaris, ach ré an áiris, áiris an lehlis is an uignis. Tréis gach éhig, gach buile fíl, taid fós i réim, suíl chéach is clúas vár, béal craifach is crí cnó, mé féin i gócht úr a bhain eile. Ní cadavach sím in éin ní, ach an línas díaní ar lína, an scéthe maria, on ifig, on rain, on devistig da hach lain, na focal vúra a deachtíag don ara ar maidin, nar vag, brov, nar ahrig, fac. Is tamid fian na hirafúr, chan cairí, is gioca go rúige, mashtíní, is madarí lahí a hraskart, an bocht, is an nocht a uaskult, is flahas an dine a ógurt. Agus fós, Tami clippehe, skwittehe, idehe, egimini, seg fucht, na feine, nach federe leis, tukig an law, ach ni go foile, egrahar.
Yes, Louis de Puer and his poem Rusk, and some lovely little turns of phrase in there. The fact that you use the phrase mefin, in there, and Chucky and Law comes in towards the end of it as well. You are having fun with the kind of, I suppose, the political slogans that are often out there, and the words that you had another point in the poem. You talk about the words that are said by the minister in the morning, you know, on the radio or wherever. You're managing to have a bit of humour around the anger in that one, Louis.
Yeah, and I suppose when you do write a poem, it's not so much the subject matter that is uppermost in your mind. You're trying to do it as well as you can. You're trying to craft the thing. And in a way, your concentration, your focus on that. So that's a fairly carefully structured poem. And I'm delighted that you notice those kind of things in it, you know. And there is a bit of humour, a bit of maybe Armando Iannucci humour in it, hopefully, with a bit of bite as well, you know. But I was deliberately trying to avoid the slogan of Chucky Gore Law. You know, the idea is that we all live in the hope that the day will dawn when there is justice and so on, but we're not doing anything about it. There's a sense of apathy, and there's an extraordinary sense of helplessness, it seems to me, in Ireland and in the world more generally recently. There's also a sense that our political leaders are on auto cue, and that we're living according to whatever is on the auto cue. And I feel it's a time of despair. And Molly was saying it there as well, you know, maybe poetry can be mobilised in the service of a hope that is driven itself by anger, and it might ultimately have some grip when other forms of rhetoric and language, journalism, for instance, does not seem to have a real grip on what's going on at the moment. It's almost as if political journalism is a form of theatre criticism, that what's being adjudicated on is the extent to which the auto cues lines are being well received by the audience or not. Well, we're not an audience. You know, we're citizens of a republic who are entitled to expect certain things, and we're clearly not being given options that would make justice a possibility in the short term.
Again, I come back to, I'm sticking with rhapsodical chant. Even when you're speaking in Merla and in prose, you have a touch of the rhapsodical chant about you, Louis, in what you've just said there as well. One of the other things, Molly, that is all part of Circling the Square, and even that title itself, you know, of course it's the title of the Denis O'Driscoll essay, but that in some ways is what Louis has been talking about there, I would suggest, and indeed what you are talking about in your previous poem and in many of your other poems as well. This idea of actually trying to get your head around something and get the shape of it. And you might have to circle the square to find out the shape of it.
Yeah, for sure. Poetry can definitely be a way of kind of trying to understand something, but often you might end up with more questions than when you first started. So
yeah, and obviously Denis O'Driscoll and his brother Declan, who's very heavily involved in the organisation of this particular festival. We asked you as well, Molly, to maybe choose a poem of Denis's for us, and maybe say why it spoke to you so closely or so dearly.
Absolutely, yeah. So I chose a poem called Years After, and this poem is about, I suppose it's directed to his mother, Catherine, who died of cancer in her 50s. And by the time Denis was 20, both of his parents had passed away. And this poem is kind of reflecting on his grief-stricken 20s and how he and his five siblings coped during that time. So I'll read it now. It's called Years After. And yet we managed fine. We missed your baking for a time. And yet, were we not better off without cream-hearted sponge cakes, flaky, rhubarb-oozing pies? Linoleum-tiled rooms could no longer presume on your thorough-goring scrub. And yet, we made up for our neglect, laid hardwood timber floors. Windows shimmered less often, and yet we got around to elbow greasing them eventually. Your daily sheet and blanket rituals of bedmaking were more than we could hope to emulate. And yet the duvets we bought brought us gradually to sleep. Declan and Ethna, 11 and 9 respectively at the time, had to survive without your packed banana sandwiches, wooden spoon, deterrent hugs, multivitamins, and yet they both grew strong. And you have unmet grandchildren, in-laws you never knew. Yes, we managed fine, made breakfasts and made love, took on jobs and mortgages, set ourselves up for life. And yet, and yet, and yet.
Years after, a poem there by Dan O'Driscoll, read for us this evening by Molly Toomey. Molly, along with Louis Dupuyre, are part of the Circling the Square Festival in Thurles this coming weekend, and both of them are speaking with me this evening. I thought it was extraordinary, Louis, that Molly had chosen that poem, given one of the other great topics or themes that is across your new collection, Kéwari Emavik Fahuna, which talks about your own family and the loss of your parents, both of your parents. There was a time, unlike Dennis's situation there, where a mother was taken away at a very young age, there was a time when you had the four generations of your family around you. You might explain that. How long did it, was it a brief period? Was it quite long, Louis?
No, it was quite long. I mean, it was a complete gift. My parents were still alive when my grandchildren, my first grandchildren were born. They lived long enough to form real relationships with their great-grandchildren. And I had this extraordinary feeling for a considerable period of time, and I still have it a little, that I was blessed, clearly, but in a way that being a link in the chain was about as close as I was ever going to get to feeling eternity here on earth. And it was a really powerful feeling. I have it in several of the poems here, but particularly in a poem called Shlina Fearinge. Would I read a bit of that? And I have a translation for it as well. Will I go between the two?
Yeah, sure. Why don't you give us a bit of that? Because it links, I think, directly into the poem that Molly has just read for us.
Okay. So, Táim Shiri in a Láhir, Ho Kriana le Bradán as a Ró, Nis Oigin a Vís im Ahir Óg, Is a Máhir Siúd im Bacling, Trí Seachtana Sarav Bartahe de Tacht, Id a Sach Vín a Marav, Tan Tom Bonos Cuno hin is meam handine cho sinant anish nor hjart me ligant tras non vohr lum fein sa dirahucht. I'm deathless in her presence, old as the salmon of Asaro, younger than I was as a young father holding her mother 3 weeks before she was due in the beginning of the month of the dead. Time has been out of kilter ever since, and I'm so old and innocent tonight I shouldn't be left cross the road on my own in the dark. All the colours the earth has gathered from the sky are sifted through the eyes of a child who can't decide which one suits her best in the light that stretches from her triangular toes to my father's grey eyes as he keeps his hand on my shoulder on the edge of the main road. The child stands between us, a lantern telling us there's no need to be afraid anymore. She won't leave here till she sees two shadows waving back from the other side she left behind just now, eternity gripped in her fist. Tan Lianav in a shas of adhering, Lochran a keen or rawling, Nach ga in agla fasta, Ni aga si an aitcha, Gavika si ga sky le banude on ait howl, A freg si ar bowl, An tiriacht fashgehe in a dorn.
Louis Dupuyre with his poem Shlina Fearinge Gaeilge agus as Gaeilge agus Amerla. Inta con Gaeilge Clistar ar RT Radio Ahain. My who, Louis, says a texter who's been in touch listening to what you've been saying and reading for us, Louis. It strikes me in that poem, it's so full of warmth and love and happiness and yet such terrible sadness as well.
Yeah, I hope that there's more than the sadness there. You know, it's given to very few people with loved ones to feel that their time has come and the time is right, and that the person leaving you feels that also. That applied even more to my mother than to my father. But yeah, I mean, one of the great advantages of beginning a family before you really should do is that there's a possibility you might get to be part of four generations. So I recommend it.
Yeah, well, sure, who knows? Don't be writing it off yet. There could be another chance for you to be part of four generations, just a bit further down the line. I don't want to land you in trouble at home, but you might tell us a little bit. You know where I'm going, of course. You might tell us a little bit. A willow rollers a going fe frodus thunig. What the title, what the poem is about, and why you wrote it.
Okay, so, I mean, it's all we know about Protestants, and it's not a sectarian poem, but my partner, my wife, is Protestant, and to this day, she gets apoplectic. at how little we appear to know about the other tradition. And it's no good telling her that, you know, I grew up in a suburb where there was one Protestant family and maybe 1,000 or 1,200 Catholic families, and that all we really knew about them was that they were tanned. They seemed to be better looking than us. They certainly had better manners than us, but we were completely ignorant of them. So the poem, I suppose, is a response to that allegation.
Would you give us a bit of it with a bit of it? I think you have a translation here as well.
Okay, I'll mix the two again.
Yeah,
so.
Please, thanks.
Dina Maconta, ni honanis shinghain, ni lisico fos, conis teienov, prati averu, na breag hjarta ancient. Ni chredin siad sa vaidan vira, na sa vaidan vara, Maria Goretti, na little Nelly, e ni ar a veder the veir a chorer, dreir George Bernard Shaw. The men are tanned, well-spoken, sincere. The women blonde, blue-eyed, agile. When they walk by, roses stand to attention. Poppies bare their wounded hearts. A Catholic crow puts his turnip head under his broken wing. Enid Blyton baptised them and taught them their secret language. Settee, couch. Preserves, jam. Pudding, dessert. Ginger beer. They don't go to confession, but speak directly to God, with no cronies, guardian angels, RTDs to help them. They're so honest, they've done nothing that requires forgiveness. Apart from that, my friend, they're every bit as bad, as odd as the rest of us, or they will be soon enough with the help of God and His Blessed Mother.
A willer old going for Frodistunig, Louis Dupuyr there, and good luck now when you go home this evening. Hope it all goes well for you.
They're very tolerant people.
Molly Toomey, just coming back to you, Molly, as we finish up. That, and you can hear the humour in what Louis gives us in that poem. Mm. How important is that side of things? You know, within, and Louis similarly pointing out in the poem about Shlina Ferrina that, you know, those who are gone, but a kind of a, yes, there's sadness there, but there's a sense of things are right. How important is it to get that balance between, you know, the anger, the sadness, the funny, the serious?
Oh, I think it's so important. Yeah, I think, and I've been trying to do that a small bit more recently with my own work and trying to bring in a little bit of the joy and the ridiculous and all of that. And it, like, I love to read poems that have humour in it. And I think it's just, it's brilliant. And sure, it can make your day to stop and read something that makes you smile or laugh.
Yeah, well, exactly that. Well, listen, thank you so much to both of you for being with us this evening. Very, very thought-provoking ideas from both of you. That's Molly Toomey and Louis Dupuyr on Arena. Circling the Square, the festival takes place on the weekend of the 18th to the 20th of October. That's not this weekend, I thought it was. Well, the following one, isn't it? At the Source Arts Centre in Thurleston, County Tipperary. Molly Toomey will read on Friday, October the 18th. Louis Dupuyr will read from his work on the 19th, and they will also take part in a discussion called Finding the Words, What is Poetry Now?, which is chaired by Declan O'Driscoll, that is Dennis's brother, who you heard mentioned in the poem, of course, that Molly read for us. You can find out full details on thesourceartscentre.ie. The Cure are one of the biggest alternative rock bands in the world, selling an estimated 30 million albums worldwide since they formed in 1978. Simon Price, music critic and author, released his A to Z on The Cure, called Curepedia, last year. The book covers band trivia, member biographies, album summaries, tours and essays on their image, politics and influences. Simon will be at the Ballina Fringe Festival this week to talk about his book and about the news of the release of the long-awaited 14th album from The Cure, that new album to be called Songs of a Lost World. Delighted to have Simon join us on the programme now from Brighton. I'll come back to the 14th album, which is a whole there's a whole entry in your Curepedia all about that 14th album. And I think it's probably one of the longest of the entries in there. But it's such a broad range of topics that you write about in the A to Z and that Curepedia, Simon. But in your own introduction, you say, if you're going to write about The Cure, you're going to have to write about everything.
Yeah. So,
explain that thought.
Well, The Cure are just one of those bands that are so multifaceted. And I think a lot of the great artists are kind of an education. You know, if you sort of become obsessed with their work, it will lead you off down all these kind of fascinating rabbit holes. And The Cure are one of those bands. So, for example, so much of their work is inspired by literature. Mm. There's a whole chapter in Curepedia about literature and how it's affected their work. And, you know, people who are fans of The Cure will go off and read those books and they'll find out about those authors. People like Mervyn Peake and Albert Camus and Charles Baudelaire and so on. They aren't just one of those bands who knock out an album that sounds exactly like the last one and people go along to the gigs and, you know, have a few drinks and go home. They are a band who feed your brain, you know. They're one of those bands. So this is part of the reason why the book is so huge. It's just, once I started looking at it, I thought, well, you know, a normal-sized biography just cannot contain this.
No.
And they've been around for 45 years as well, you know.
There's a lot to get in there. I do want to get a little bit of music in for sure. And yeah. I'm going to go to the track that, in fact, brought you to The Cure. Let's have a listen to The Walk, first of all, and you can explain how it brought you to them later on. Just a little flavour. So does that bring you back, Simon Price, to Top of the Pops back in the day? Because I think that was, this was from The Cure's second album. And it really was the song that made you, I think, sit up and say, oh, there's something different going on here.
It's actually a bit later than the second album. Mm. It was actually, it was in this kind of interim where they nearly broke up and there are only two members left. They basically become a synth duo temporarily. And it was a roll of the dice for them because their manager just thought, well, all this sort of doom and gloom gothic music that we've been making hasn't really got us anywhere and it's caused the band to basically fall apart. Shall we try writing some pop songs? And they tried. They wrote three, Let's Go to Bed, The Walk, and The Love Cats, and each one of them got a higher and higher chart position, and suddenly they were in magazines like Smash Hits, which was being read by teenagers like myself, you know, and they were appearing on Top of the Pops, and sort of, you know, you see something like Robert Smith with his, you know, mad hairdo and his bright red lipstick, and I think he had dark glasses during that performance, and you're thinking, well, what's going on with these guys? What's motivating them? What are they about? And it intrigues you, and you sort of investigate them further.
Also,
historically, they were one of the first bands with that song the first alternative bands, anyway, to sort of make an alternative take on electronic dance music, shall we say. There's a whole debate whether New Order got there first with Blue Monday and various other things. People have compared The Walk to Blue Monday. I've gone into that whole debate in the book. It's a little bit inconclusive. But, yeah, they were quite groundbreaking in their day.
Yeah, and of course, and I'll come to that 14th album that I mentioned, because there is an entry. The one, you have an entry around The Walk called W is for The Walk. You have another one called F is for 14th album. It's finally coming our way. I think you've got three pages of text on the various moments at which it was or wasn't going to happen, but it definitely is on the way. But Smith, and it links in with what you just said, Smith has always said, I'm an artist. I think you quote this at one point. I'm an artist. I'm not just a member of a band. He was only ever going to do this when he felt it was right.
Yeah, he's very perfectionist about things, and he can afford to be because with the kind of body of work behind him that he has, he doesn't have to prove anything. And there's no particular hurry because as a live band, they've just become more and more popular in the gap between albums, you know. So there's no great commercial reason to do it. It was just to do it when he felt right. And yeah, it's quite funny. In the book, I've gone back through years and years of interviews where he said, it's coming next year. And then, oh, well, it's coming the year after and so on. But I think you know, it's the moment's right, and the way they've handled the build up to this has been so skillful, just dropping little hints, like putting a poster on a wall of the pub where they played their first gig and stuff like that, just with the title on it. And it's got everybody super excited. And it's probably going to be the biggest Cure album for about 30, 35 years, I would think.
And I know you have a non-disclosure agreement in terms in terms of the album itself. But you have, I think you can tell me this, you have sat and had a chance to listen through the album, have you?
I have sat and listened to the album, and my review will be in Record Collector magazine the day before the album comes out. But one thing that Robert's been fairly open about is that this is a fairly kind of doom and gloom record. You know, it's not, there aren't any cheerful, there's no kind of Friday I'm in Love or Boys Don't Cry or Love Cats kind of pop song on there, that's for sure. But I think it's a masterpiece. So, you know, without going into specifics, I can say I think it's just a magnificent piece of work. I really do.
Well, okay. You might, the people of Ballina might be able to squeeze a little bit more information
out
of
it.
They might. They might be. And obviously, we're only getting a kind of whistle stop tour around the very lengthy Curepedia. You'll be sharing lots more of those Cure thoughts, I'm sure, with the audiences at Ballina when you get here. Thanks for being with us this evening, Simon. That's Simon Price. And Cass. Simon will be at the Ballina Fringe Festival on this Friday, October the 11th, at Lily's Bar in Ballina. And you'll get full details on ballinafringefestival.ie. That is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy researched, Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, Aisling Grufferty was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.